Hey, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 241. And it is April 9th. I think everything's working here. Okay, that's really nice. I can turn some of these lights down, like that one and that one. How's that? Too dark? Too dark? Oh, it's good. Okay, fantastic. Okay, looking at the schedule. Today is the 9th, and we're going to finish up endocrinology chapter, which is 11, and move into muscle, which is 12. And we'll see. Okay, and then we still want to cover chapter 13, which is blood, heart, and circulation before the next exam, which is when? 1-2, exactly 2 weeks away from today. Okay? All right, so that's the story as I know it. And I don't see any questions. So we're going to move on to finishing up endocrinology. Okay, so endocrinology is the study of endocrine glands and signaling molecules. What are these signaling molecules called? Hormones, that's right. So an endocrine gland secretes a hormone, and a hormone has to enter the circulatory system or travels to a distant location, binds to a target tissue, and elicits a specific response, a physiologic response, so it changes the physiology of that cell. So what makes a target tissue? A receptor. It has to have a receptor. All right, and generally we can break hormones down into two classifications, two categories. What are the two categories that I'm thinking about? Okay, two categories would be hydrophilic or hydrophobic. Okay, so as a matter of fact, you should start thinking of your whole universe that way. That's really important. And so what molecules, let's talk about the hydrophilic molecules. Where are the receptors for hydrophilic molecules? That's right, on the outside of the cell membrane, because they can't diffuse through the cell membrane, because cell membrane is lipid. And that's what I'm showing you right here. There's one example of a hormone that is hydrophilic, can't get through the cell membrane, so the receptor is on the exterior side or the interstitial side of the cell membrane, right? And those here, you see all the phospholipids. So I want you to become aware of this scheme. This one, in this particular case, this is a G-protein coupled receptor. When the hormone binds, it activates the G-protein, and the G-protein dissociates and can move around within the cell membrane or on the surface of the cell membrane. And this alpha subunit can bump into an enzyme and it can activate an enzyme. This is adenylate cyclase. You know, adenylate cyclase will break down ATP into a cyclic AMP. Cyclic AMP is what kind of thing? How would you talk about cyclic AMP? What kind of thing? Where do you find it? Yeah, what do you find always in the cytoplasm? A second messenger, right? So first messenger is hormone, second messenger is cyclic AMP, and that's going to it's going to have a whole bunch of different effects, but it's going to change the physiology inside the cell. And you can see by maybe activating or inactivating kinases or phosphatases, right? That will change the physiology inside the cell. What was another scheme? So here we see hormone signal being transduced by G-protein coupled receptor, and that will activate an enzyme, okay, producing cyclic AMP. Here is another G-protein coupled receptor. Hormone binds to it, first messenger. A subunit will go over to another enzyme, and this particular enzyme will produce IPE3. Substrate is a phospholipid, and that becomes the second messenger inside the cell. And I thought I had one more slide, but I bet I don't have one more slide. To show you one last thing. How do I, come on, let's go. Nope. All right, so both of these slides that I showed you right here is when a hormone activates an enzyme in the membrane. There are other ways that G-protein coupled receptors can activate proteins in the membrane, and that is, you saw a slide of this not too long ago, but it wasn't in this chapter, I don't think. When a G-protein dissociates because there's a hormone binding to the receptor, it not only can bump into an enzyme changing its activity, it can also bump into a protein that spans the whole length of, not the whole length, but the whole width of a membrane that goes from one side all the way to the other. And that's what we want to call a channel. That's right, a channel. And that activated G protein can either open that channel or close that channel. So there are two ways, right, that we're going to focus on. One is by activating an enzyme, and the other is by opening an ion channel. Yeah. Can it do? It certainly could. I don't know of a specific example of that. Okay. Except maybe on one of these next slides that I see right here. Okay. So here we have a nice liver cell. And you know, liver cells are really nice and altruistic because they can secrete glucose into the bloodstream when blood glucose starts to decrease. No other cell will do that. So how do they do that? Well, glycogen is a huge molecule. It's a big, huge polymer of glucose. It can't get into the circulatory system, right? But what's the building block of glycogen? Yeah, glucose, right? Via glycogenesis, that's how it's produced. Well, there are enzymes that will chop glucose off from glycogen, and when it does so, it phosphorylates that glucose molecule. That's just part of the process. So that's a kinase, a protein kinase that will do that. So how does the liver cell know when to take sugar out of glycogen or put sugar into glycogen? Here is a scheme where the cell is being told to secrete glucose, break down glycogen and actually secrete glucose. And is glucose metabolism or blood glucose, is that something that people should be concerned about? Yeah, because diabetes mellitus, right, is a very prevalent disease process involving some of these things. All right, so there's going to be a signaling molecule, and it's in this particular case, it's going to be epinephrine, right? And I see epinephrine over on the other side of the cell. Epinephrine binds to a G-protein coupled receptor. That whole mechanism isn't drawn in right here because it's too complicated, but it was on one of those previous slides that I showed you. It activates adenylate cyclase, makes cyclic AMP, and that is a second messenger that activates a protein kinase that can cleave glucose from glycogen. And since it's a kinase, it also adds a phosphate to that glucose that's released. All right, so this is an example of a G-protein coupled receptor activating an enzyme. But that's not all that epinephrine can do. Epinephrine can also bind to another G-protein coupled receptor, okay, that we see on the other side of this slide. And what happens here is that the dissociated G-protein will bump into a calcium channel and open it up. All right, and so now calcium can enter the cell. Calcium binds to calmodulin that will activate a protein kinase, which can cleave glucose off from glycogen and phosphorylate it at the same time. All right, so here we see an enzyme that is necessary for the liver cell to secrete glucose, and here we see an ion channel that is being used to increase blood glucose. Okay, so both of these, and these are both adrenergic receptors. Okay, all right, so that kind of answers your question a little bit. And that's where we ended up last time on this particular slide. So I think that's really nice that you see this because you're very much aware of how important glucose is, and now you know how that G-protein coupled receptor fits into the scheme really, really nicely. And into an organ, you all should know exactly where it is and what it looks like and all that kind of stuff. Yeah, question. Was there a question?
So two of them, it's the purpose, it burns down the glucose into the glucose.
Okay. The function of both of these receptors, okay, is to secrete glucose from the liver cell. Yep. And so what happens to blood glucose? When the G protein over here gets activated and the G protein coupled over here receptor gets activated, or either one or both. What's the result? Okay. Yeah, what goes up?
Blood glucose.
Ah, blood glucose goes up. Right? So I just kind of make a note of that. We're going to see a lot of different mechanisms that increase blood glucose and very few that decrease blood glucose. So if you see a lot of mechanisms that increase blood glucose, what does that lend to? Diabetes, right? Because diabetes is characterized by abnormally high levels of glucose. Okay. All right, so here is another receptor that's very important, in glucose metabolism. This is a tyrosine kinase second messenger system. So here is an insulin molecule. Insulin is hydrophilic, cannot get inside the cell. So where does the receptor have to be? Extracellular, exactly right. And this is kind of a nice example of what a tyrosine kinase receptor looks like, right? It has two proteins that span the membrane, and these things can dimerize when insulin is present. They can come together, right? So this is the signaling molecule. Insulin is the signaling molecule, and I want you to see that insulin is the passport that actually allows glucose to enter the cell. And it's going to take a couple slides for me to show you that. There are a number of tyrosine kinase receptors in your body. This is just one really important one. With insulin, we have dimerization of these two membrane-spanning proteins. And when they dimerize, it just so happens that the intracellular part of this receptor has an ATPase associated with it. And when it comes together just like that, the active site is in the perfect shape to accept an ATP, and that ATP is hydrolyzed, gives you ADP, and in the process, it phosphorylates the tyrosine kinase receptor. Right? And so why do we call this a tyrosine kinase receptor? Tyrosine kinase. What does a kinase do? It adds a phosphate to something, right? So here is that enzyme that adds a phosphate to itself. And in particular, where on this protein does it add a phosphate? On a tyrosine amino acid someplace in this long chain. Okay, so hence a tyrosine kinase receptor. All right, when that happens, then the tyrosine kinase receptor, once it's phosphorylated, can't phosphorylate other kinds of signaling molecules or enzymes inside the cell. Right, and so there could be a cascade of effects, many stages of enzymatic reactions, and that's going to finally lead to glucose uptake and maybe some other anabolic reactions. Right, so catabolic is what? Breaking the big thing down. Anabolic is making polymers from something. All right, so this is still very general, right? Because I didn't show you any of these other molecules that are being phosphorylated. So there are many steps, right? If it's a cascade, it's many steps. So diabetes mellitus, right, might not be due just to insulin problems, right, but it could be due as a result of malformation of the tyrosine kinase receptor. It could be a receptor problem, or it could be a problem with this cascade mechanism inside the cell. So diabetes mellitus can be a very complicated kind of disease, and we're just really kind of scratching the surface on how to treat it effectively. Okay. It would be simple if somebody is just missing insulin, but their tyrosine kinase receptor is fine, this cascade mechanism is fine, because then we can just, what, administer, or they can administer insulin to themselves. When would somebody administer insulin to themselves? There are two possible states you can be in. You could be in the fed state or fasted state. So what state? Okay. If somebody gives themselves a shot of insulin in the fasted state, they'll pass out. Okay, so not in the fasted state, it's in the fed state when glucose is being absorbed by the digestive system. That's when insulin should be given, so that, it's not shown on this slide, so that glucose can enter the cell. Right, not in a fasted state, in a fed state. Right before you eat is probably good, but don't plan on eating something, have an insulin shot, and then forget to eat or get distracted. Okay. That would be a problem. That's right. And you probably wouldn't do that too many times. Yeah. So it has to be in close proximity to when you're eating. Yeah.
On the previous slide, does glucagon come into the picture at all?
Glucagon, yes. Yes.
Okay.
But not with this kind of receptor.
No, the previous slide.
How come I forgot how to go back? Oh, this one right here.
Yeah.
Oh, on this particular slide, glucagon, it helps glycogenesis. And I don't know what kind of receptor it is. Okay. Okay. All right, so let's continuing focusing on this tyrosine kinase receptor. How is it that when insulin binds to the receptor, it allows glucose to enter the cell. All right, so my question is, if there's glucose outside the cell at high concentration, glucose inside the cell at low concentration, which way would it want to move all by itself?
Inside.
Yeah, it will want to move inside, right? So that's kind of funny that somebody with diabetes mellitus has really high glucose in their blood, right, and low inside the cells. These cells are starving for glucose, but glucose still can't diffuse across the membrane, of course, because glucose is hydrophilic. All right, so this is how we understand how this system works. Next slide. Okay, so here we have a cell, right, and we're missing the nucleus and mitochondria and a whole bunch of organelles. What I do see are some vesicles inside the cell, and these are particular vesicles that we call endosomes, right? You know vesicles to be lysosomes, right, and peroxisomes, and you're familiar with the compounds that they contain. But this one here is an endosome. And do you see anything special about this endosome when you look at the membrane that's making it up? I see some proteins embedded in the membrane right here, right, in the endosome. These proteins are going to be used to allow glucose to go across the cell membrane. But when they're in the endosome membrane, they can't work, right, because they have to be in the plasma membrane. So when insulin binds to this receptor, it becomes phosphorylated, and consequently it phosphorylates other signaling molecules, then it causes these vesicles, right, which we call endosomes, to translocate to the cell membrane. And this membrane of the endosome and the membrane of the cell is exactly the same, so they're going to fuse together very nicely. And hence, these proteins are transported and inserted into the cell membrane, right, which they are now active. So these endosomes are a reservoir of these. You're going to see these to be a transporter of glucose, and in particular a GLUT4 transporter. So when they're in the endosome, right, they're inactive, but when they move to the cell membrane as a result of insulin binding to that tyrosine kinase receptor, now they can go ahead and do their job. So glucose can enter, right, that GLUT4 transporter when it binds to the active site. It's like poking you in the side. This protein is going to change conformation. At first, it was open to the extracellular side. When glucose binds, it's going to open to the intracellular side. And I don't see that happening on this particular illustration. But what would happen? Glucose then would be free to enter the cell. That's how glucose enters the cell. So this is a GLUT4 transporter. And what kind of transport mechanism is this? I can only wait about 10 seconds. What kind of process is this? What process is happening here?
Endocytosis.
Oh, yeah, that's pretty good. Yeah, it is endocytosis. That's not what I was looking for. Okay, another 5 seconds. Okay. Okay. Do you see ATP?
No.
I don't see ATP. It's passive.
Yeah.
If it's not active, it's got to be passive. My question is, what kind of passive transport? Okay. Could it be osmosis? The answer is no, because osmosis requires the solvent molecule. It has to be water. And what are we looking at? Glucose, not water. So it's not osmosis. What is something going from high concentration to low concentration? Diffusion. Yeah, it's diffusion, right? But it can't get through the cell membrane. It needs this transporter right here. What kind of diffusion is that? It's what we call facilitated diffusion. Okay, probably all of you were thinking that, but you're too shy to shout it out loud. Okay, facilitated diffusion. So GLUT4 transporters, right, just allow for facilitated diffusion, and now this cell is not going to starve to death, which is really nice. Yeah, question.
So you're saying that after the insulin goes in, it phosphorylates, it moves the proteins from the inside to the outside of the outside?
When insulin binds to the tyrosine kinase receptor, there's a whole cascade of enzymes that are activated. And those enzymes then will allow for the translocation of these endosomes, which are deep inside the cell, over to the cell membrane.
Okay.
And then whatever in the membrane of those endosomes then functionally become part of the plasma membrane. Okay? And so why is this really handy? Well, what would happen if insulin bound to a receptor and you didn't have any GLUT4 transporters in the cell? Okay? All right. Then, if in order to get those transporters in the cell membrane, you would have to go through gene activation, you would have to transcribe DNA into messenger RNA, and then you'd have to take that messenger RNA, translate it into a protein, take those proteins and assemble them and put them in the cell membrane, and that would take a lot longer to do than just by inserting this endosome into the cell membrane, right? So these endosomes are a reservoir of GLUT4 transporters that are inserted into the cell membrane under what kind of conditions in a normal individual? High blood glucose or low blood glucose? High blood glucose, because in a normal individual, insulin will be secreted from the pancreas, right? So these endosomes are really fancy. It's just a way of getting these GLUT4 transporters into the cell membrane rapidly, really fast. Okay, any questions on that? Okay, pituitary gland. Important endocrine gland, right? So I'm going to skip a lot of anatomy, all right? But the pituitary is just underneath the hypothalamus, connected to the hypothalamus by the infundibulum. That's like a little tiny bridge between the hypothalamus. Infundibulum does contain some really nifty tracts. What is a tract? What's a tract? It's white matter, okay? White matter, yeah, but that's just a piece of what I really would like to know. The white matter was just a hint. Yeah, it's a bundle of axons. And, of course, they're myelinated, so it looks white. So it's axons taking information someplace, right? And these axons, the cell body is in the hypothalamus. The axons move down through the infundibulum, and the axon terminus is in the posterior pituitary. All right, so sometimes we call this the neural hypothesis because it contains axons from cell bodies in the hypothalamus. And you could consider this really nervous tissue. Well, we're going to see why do we call this an endocrine gland. Now, the anterior pituitary is totally different, right? It's not made of nervous tissue. It's made of cells that secrete, and it secretes hormones. So this is the glandular part of the pituitary. Sometimes we call this adenohypothesis. Adeno means gland, secreting gland. Okay, the hypothalamus controls the secretion from both the posterior as well as the anterior lobe of the pituitary gland. And maybe in physiology, in anatomy, you learn how that happens, but if you didn't, we have to go over it right now. All right, so let's look at the posterior pituitary first. All right, so here are a couple nuclei in the walls of the hypothalamus, paraventricular nucleus, and then here's one right above the optic chiasma, so this is what we call the supraoptic nucleus, cell bodies, so these are nuclei, right, because they have nerve cell bodies and dendrites, not myelinated, so they look gray. Then here are the myelinated axons. This is a tract, right, that goes through the infundibulum. The axon terminus is in the posterior pituitary. When an action potential comes down these axons, right, it will either release antidiuretic hormone, which is what we see ADH, or oxytocin. And so I think I want to talk a little bit about ADH and oxytocin right now, even though it might not be on the next slide. Okay. ADH, another name for antidiuretic hormone, is called vasopressin. What's another name for ADH? Yeah, oh, I forgot. What's another name for ADH? Yeah, very good. Don't forget that, like I just did, okay? And it runs around with both of those names, okay? But I'm sure you realize you have more than one name, too, so that's not a really big surprise. ADH. One effect, okay, is that it helps your body conserve water. Right, antidiuretic. A diuretic will make you pee. An antidiuretic will make you withhold water. All right, and we're going to talk about what that does pretty soon. So it helps water balance, but if you retain water, that also helps maintain blood pressure. Okay. A real simple way of thinking about this at this stage in the class probably is think of your car tire. And if the pressure is low, do you take air out or do you put air in? You put air in, exactly right. So if a person's blood pressure is low, do you take fluid out or put fluid in? Yeah, you put fluid in, and antidiuretic hormone is just a way to maintain the fluid so the person doesn't lose it to help maintain blood pressure. Vasopressin is because antidiuretic hormone or vasopressin also can cause constriction of smooth muscle around blood vessels. And when it constricts, okay, let's think of a balloon. You got a balloon and you squeeze down on the balloon. Can you imagine what happens to pressure inside the balloon? It goes up, right? And if you squeeze really hard, the pressure goes up so much it pops. That's terrible when that happens in a person. That's how ADH got its name for that vasoconstriction. It's called vasopressin. The second hormone, so there's only two from the posterior pituitary, is oxytocin. And I suppose it's kind of related to vasopressin because it's excitatory on smooth muscle, not so much vascular, but on the glandular tissue of the breast and also uterus. And so it causes uterine constrictions and constrictions of glands in the breast. And so oxytocin is important for parturition. It just so happens that there's a nice positive feedback mechanism that increases oxytocin secretion when the fetus knows it's ready to be born or thinks it's ready to be born. That's what controls parturition. It's not the mom, it's the baby. And the mother then secretes oxytocin, which contracts the uterus, right? So the uterus squeezes down. What happens to the fetus then? What does the fetus feel as the uterus starts to constrict down on it? It's confined, right? And it feels pressure. And that produces anxiety, right? So the fetus produces anxiety hormones, which go into the maternal circulation, which cause secretion of oxytocin. And what happens to the uterus? Constricts even more, right? That stresses the baby even more, which secretes stress hormones, which then causes the release of more oxytocin. All right, so how come the whole universe isn't filled up with oxytocin? Because here's a nice positive feedback mechanism. What always has to happen? Something drastic happens. What's the drastic thing that happens? Yeah, you have that baby, okay? And so all those signals then get reset and the positive feedback mechanism goes away. All right, so positive feedback mechanisms are pretty rare, but they always result due to some kind of abrupt change in the system that's taking place. All right, so that's for the posterior pituitary. The signals move as an electrical signal from the brain down into the posterior pituitary. And I see a blood vessel right here. So ADH and oxytocin actually enter the blood, and once they're in the blood, where do they go? Everywhere that blood goes, right? And what kind of blood vessels do these have to be? These have to be capillaries, exactly right. So what did we learn about a cell that produces a signaling compound, secretes it so that it's picked up by the circulatory system, delivered to a distant site where it produces a specific response? What is that signaling molecule called? Hormone. That's a hormone. All right, so here we have what? What is secreting a hormone? A neuron. It's not glandular tissue. So what do we usually call something that's secreted from an axon terminus? A neurotransmitter, right? So what is ADH and oxytocin? Is it a neurotransmitter or is it a hormone? Okay, it's a combination of both, right? So it is a neurohormone. And in a lot of classes, you have a chapter that really doesn't separate the nervous system from the endocrine system because they function together. Here is just one example, right, where you can't really separate the endocrine system from the nervous system. Okay, do you see any axons going into the anterior pituitary? No, I don't see any at all. But nonetheless, the hypothalamus does control the anterior pituitary. Let's see how that happens. Oh, look at this. Oh, look what's on this slide. Where do I have my cursor working? Nope. Maybe you can't see it. Okay. My cursor is right below vasopressin. What's another name for vasopressin?
ADH.
Yeah, so just remember, this ADH is the same thing as this thing over here in the text part. Okay. All right, so how does the hypothalamus control secretions from the anterior pituitary? There aren't tracts that go down there, right? Here are some cell bodies from nuclei in the hypothalamus. The axons are relatively short. They just go to the base of the infundibulum that we call the median eminence, and they secrete a compound that gets picked up by a capillary, right? And so these things are neurohormones, get into the capillary, and once they get into this capillary system, where do they go? Everywhere in the body, and if they go everywhere in the body, they get tremendously diluted out, right? So here is something special, a special door-to-door delivery system. Indeed, they do enter the blood. They go into a blood vessel that takes them directly to the anterior pituitary, where it bumps into another capillary network. Those neurohormones then diffuse out into the anterior pituitary, and therefore they're not diluted with the whole circulatory system, right, because of this door-to-door delivery system. Okay, so generally, what do we call a blood vessel that connects two capillary beds back-to-back before it goes back to the heart? That's what we call a portal vascular system, right? There's a hepatic portal system. There's one in the kidney called peritubular, called the efferent arteriole. But here is a portal blood vessel. This is really important for you to know. This is the hypophyseal. Hypophysis is another name for the pituitary. Hypothalamo-hypophyseal portal blood vessel. And this is the portal blood system. All right, so then these neurohormones cause the secretion from the glandular tissue of the anterior pituitary. So now you notice that there aren't any hormones listed here on this slide because it would be just way too confusing. So here is an exam figure that's really nice, right? It shows a number of hormones that are secreted by the anterior pituitary, namely prolactin, growth hormone, FSH, well, I'll just say it once, follicle stimulating hormone, luteinizing hormone, adrenal corticotropic hormone. Where's the adrenal cortex? Is that the superficial or deep part of the adrenal gland? Cortex is always the superficial part of an organ, right? Renal cortex, superficial part. Cortical bone, the dense bone on the outside, right? So it is this part of the adrenal gland that adrenal corticotropic hormone activates. Here's the adrenal medulla, okay, and this is a sympathetic organ. This is what releases norepinephrine and epinephrine when the preganglionic sympathetic fiber brings in electrical impulses. And then thyroid stimulating hormone. So I do want you to know what the effect of each of these hormones is. Maybe on this slide you could write down what it is. But we said, what was oxytocin used for? Breastfeeding, but what kind? Okay, yeah, milk letdown reflex. So oxytocin is necessary for milk to leave the breast. Okay, so what is this prolactin all about? Prolactin is necessary during gestation for development of the glandular tissue. So you need prolactin so the breast can develop to become competent to secrete milk, and then you need another signal that actually will cause the secretion of milk from the breast. Okay, so there's quite a bit of difference between prolactin. If there's no prolactin and oxytocin, will there be a milk letdown reflex? No, there won't be any milk produced when that happens. Okay. All right, growth hormone just promotes growth of bone, muscle, and even adipose tissue, especially during development. Low levels will stunt the growth of an individual. Gonadotropins control reproductive functions, can control ovulation, helps control gestation, implantation, all kinds of different things. When we get into that chapter, we're going to talk about that. All right, so FSH and LH both work on an ovary and a testes, ovary in female, testes in male. Adrenal corticotropic hormone causes the cortex to grow, maintain itself, and also secrete some hormones. And the thyroid stimulating hormone from anterior pituitary causes the thyroid gland to grow, or hypertrophy, right? And then secrete hormones that it makes. It makes thyroid hormone. Right, so TSH causes the thyroid gland to secrete thyroxin. All right, so some of these hormones are trophic hormones. All of the hormones that are released by are the neurohormones secreted by the hypothalamus. You can consider these trophic hormones because they cause the release of other hormones. And those other hormones can control the release of still other hormones. All right, so kind of a long and involved process. So here is a list of what these hormones do. Right? And so these are really the only hormones. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. 6 hormones that I want you to know about from the anterior pituitary. Here's another important thing. Since FSH and LH help regulate what's happening in an ovary and a testes, sometimes we call these things gonads, right? FSH and LH are called gonadotropins. All right, so without gonadotropins, ovaries and testes won't function properly.
Are you saying there's more than 6? You're just having us focus on 6?
I'm going to have you focus on 6. Yeah. Okay. The anterior pituitary, let's see what we have right here. Here's a hypothalamo-portal system. Okay, the only thing that we haven't talked about yet are these neural hormones. They're not on this slide. So maybe I'll just draw something on the board. Hopefully this marker works really nice. What do we know about these trophic hormones? All right, so what do I want to draw first? Probably I want to draw, well, what does that look like to you? Hopefully in the back you can see this. This is the hypothalamus. I think that's my darkest marker. What's darker in the back? Probably the second one I wrote with. Okay, so here's what? Hypothalamus. Okay, and then here is the pituitary gland, kind of separated. So here is the posterior pituitary. What is this? Anterior pituitary. Adenohypophysis. Neurohypophysis. All right. So how is the anterior pituitary controlled by the hypothalamus? Are there tracts that go down? There's a portal blood system, right? So the hypothalamus secretes neurohormones because there's neurons in there that go to the anterior pituitary. Anterior pituitary is then going to secrete a hormone. So let's just say the anterior pituitary is going to secrete FSH and LH. What are these two hormones called together? Gonadotropins, right? Gonadotropin. All right, so how does the hypothalamus tell the anterior pituitary to release these gonadotropins? Because there are neurons here that release a compound called gonadotropin-releasing hormone. Right? Gonadotropin-releasing hormone goes to the anterior pituitary, and then the anterior pituitary releases FSH and LH. Okay? So sometimes these are called releasing factors. So this could be GNRF. I think your book uses hormone. All right, but just really remember what it's a neural hormone. All right, now what about thyroid-stimulating hormone? What part of the pituitary does that come from, anterior or posterior? Anterior, right, because posterior is oxytocin and ADH. All right, so anterior pituitary, right, is going to secrete thyroid-stimulating hormone, which goes to the thyroid gland. How does the anterior pituitary know to release thyroid-stimulating hormone? Because hypothalamus is going to secrete thyroid-stimulating hormone, releasing hormone, goes over here. Okay, what about, what's another one? What's a, another good one? Okay, anterior pituitary is going to secrete adrenal corticotropic hormone. How does the anterior pituitary know to release ACTH? Because it's going to get a signal from the hypothalamus, which is what? ACTH-RH. Sometimes it's abbreviated CRH or CRF, right, just to be short. But they're just releasing hormones or releasing factors. All of these releasing hormones, releasing factors are neurohormones from the median eminence of various nuclei. Right, so releasing hormones from the hypothalamus control the secretion of other hormones from the anterior pituitary. releasing hormones don't control the release of oxytocin or vasopressin, because there's a tract that brings that information down. Okay.
So the ACTH
ACTH. So here's ACTHRH. Goes to the anterior pituitary via the portal system. That causes release of adrenal corticotropic hormone. And since it's a hormone, gets in the blood, goes everywhere. What's the target tissue for ACTH? Adrenal corticotropic hormone will be the adrenal cortex in particular, right? Not the adrenal medulla, just that one particular part. Okay. Well, that might seem really simple to you, right? And it really kind of is, after you look at it a couple times, maybe. Okay, so what are these? See the cursor right here in the hypothalamus? What are these neurons secreting within the median eminence? What are these? What are they secreting? Neural hormones, right? And you could generate a bunch of list of neural hormones if you know the hormones that the anterior pituitary secretes. Right, so there are sometimes inhibitory, and sometimes they are excitatory. So here you see a number of organs. Hypothalamus, secreting neural hormones, anterior pituitary, secreting hormones that go to even another gland that's going to secrete hormones. I didn't mention this before, but here are the gonads. Gonads do synthesize and secrete hormones, right? And in the female, it will be either estrogen or progesterone, sometimes maybe a little bit of both of those. But in the male, it's not estrogen and progesterone, it is testosterone, right? Or androgens. Okay, so how do we maintain negative feedback? Well, the result of hormones from this terminal target tissue can feed back, right, to other sources that produce neurohormones or hormones. So, for instance, when the gonads produce estrogens, right, estrogens can feed back to the anterior pituitary. And what would the anterior pituitary have to do? It will say, it will tell the gonads, gee whiz, we have enough estrogen or androgens in the blood, you don't need to make any more. So what happens to gonadotropins? They decrease, that's right, or stop, right, to maintain. So this is a nice negative feedback mechanism. Okay, now these are gonadotropins. This causes this causes the gonads to maintain their shape, okay, and their size and their function. So what might happen to somebody that is taking exogenous androgens or anabolic steroids to build muscle mass? Who might want to do that? Yeah, who might want to do that? I'd be really shocked if Schwarzenegger didn't do that at some point, right? Anybody, bodybuilders, for instance, okay? So what's going to happen to these big, powerful athletes if they're taking androgens? That's going to feed back to the anterior pituitary? Yeah, these glands are going to shrink down, okay, as a result of that, okay? Okay, so instead of regular-sized gonads, they have like little raisinettes. So there's always what? There's always side effects to things that we do to ourselves. Not only is there negative feedback to the anterior pituitary, but there is negative feedback to the hypothalamus, right? So estrogens and androgens can cause the decrease of GnRH as well. Okay, so there are various feedback mechanisms. And since the hypothalamus is involved with release of these hormones, right, emotional states or psychological stresses can influence the secretion of neural hormones from the hypothalamus. And of course, it can have all kinds of effects within the body depending on what hormone is changing. Okay, here is ADH, vasopressin. We talked about that already. The nuclei, paraventricular secrete oxytocin from the posterior pituitary, supraoptic secrete oxytocin, right, due to endocrine reflexes. So were done with the pituitary gland, anterior and posterior. Adrenal gland, you know where they are because you passed anatomy, right? They're just sitting right on top of the kidney, and you know it's kind of a complex gland. Generally, we can break it up into medulla and cortex. Cortex is the superficial part. And if we look at the cortex, we can even see layers within the cortex. And these different layers will produce different kinds of hormones. Right? But I'm not so concerned that you know that of the different layers of what the names are and what hormones they secrete. I think you should just know that these layers exist, right? And that they are responsible for secreting different hormones. Okay. So the medulla, we know, secretes epinephrine and norepinephrine to maintain sympathetic response. The cortex is controlled by ACTH, right? And as a result, ACTH will cause the secretion of cortisol and aldosterone. Cortisol is what we call a glucocorticoid, and aldosterone is a mineralocorticoid. So cortisol is involved with glucose metabolism. Aldosterone, right, is involved with sodium and potassium metabolism inside the body. Gee whiz. Why are sodium and potassium important? Have you ever heard of sodium and potassium being important? Yeah, right, because of membrane potential, for instance, and even secondary active transport. So maintaining the proper levels of sodium and potassium is extremely important. And so you're going to have to really know what the effect of aldosterone is, because it is so important in regulating blood pressure even. Right? So aldosterone causes the kidneys to resorb sodium and to secrete potassium. So what does that mean? Which way is sodium going? Let's talk about sodium. Which way is sodium going? From outside the body to inside? From filtrate back into the blood. Filtrate is going to be lost in urine, right? It will become urine, so this is a way to maintain sodium. What about secretion of potassium? This is going from blood to filtrate, so you will lose potassium. So what direction is sodium and potassium? Are they both leaving? Are they both entering? Or do they go in opposite directions? Yeah, opposite directions. First, know at least that, right? So if you get this, you'll probably get this on a board exam sometime in your life. So you might have a bunch of answers. One that you will select is sodium and potassium going in opposite directions, right? Now, is there something else in your body that you're aware of where sodium and potassium go in opposite directions? The sodium-potassium ATP pump. That's right. Okay, and last week of this class, we're going to see that sodium-potassium ATP pump is responsible for the effects of aldosterone. Okay, that's really what drives the system. So that will help you remember that. And also the adrenal gland secretes some sex steroids. Yeah?
I'm sorry, you said for aldosterone, it was
called mineralo, like mineral corticoid. Mineralocorticoid. Cortisol, glucocorticoid. Right. And are these hydrophilic or hydrophobic?
They're hydrophobic,
right? Because they're steroids, right? So steroids are lipids, right? So how does your body make these? Well, it makes them from cholesterol. That's why I have this slide on here. Cholesterol is the precursor for mineralocorticoids. Ah, here you have it on the slide, as well as glucocorticoids, as well as sex steroids. Okay, so I don't want you to know any of these intermediates, but I just want you to know that cholesterol is a precursor for aldosterone. Cholesterol is a precursor for corticosterone and cortisol. Right, remember, these help regulate glucose metabolism, aldosterone, sodium, and potassium. And also the adrenal cortex is responsible for secreting androgens. No estrogens, but androgens. And that happens in the male as well as the female. Right, so females do have androgens, and I feel really bad about that because they have three hormones, we only have one, right? So all you ladies in there, you should be sensitive to the plight of us guys. Okay, that's just one example. Okay, so what do these sex steroids do from the adrenal cortex? What are they necessary for? Sex drive, right, and aggressive behavior. And of course, without sex drive, there would be no human race, right? So for sure, that's why they're there. And what about aggressive behavior? What gender would you think is more aggressive, males or females?
Females,
definitely, by far, okay? And maybe just one real simple example I would mention to you, and that is maternal behavior protecting young, okay? I would much rather walk into a male grizzly bear than a female grizzly bear with her cubs, right? Okay. All right, so that's the adrenal cortex. Adrenal medulla, that's just an important part of the autonomic nervous system. And it's going to release epinephrine and norepinephrine, mostly epinephrine, that increases respiratory rate, increases heart rate, a general vasoconstriction. So again, when vasoconstriction takes place, what happens to blood pressure? It goes up. Okay, so that's your blood pressure goes up, and it does that because blood vessels constrict, but also because it increases something we call venous return. And you have no idea what that means, but we're going to talk about that almost in the next chapter. All right, so you can kind of put that aside for now, but increasing venous return will increase blood pressure. And these also stimulate glycogenolysis. All right, glycogenolysis. So what happens to blood glucose? What happens to blood glucose as a result of glycogenolysis? It increases. So here's another mechanism that increases blood pressure. I mean, not blood pressure, blood glucose concentrations. Right, and we're not going to see many things that decrease blood glucose concentration. And lipolysis. Lipolysis is a way to get beta oxidation started, which will produce a lot of ATP for whatever you need to do in that fight or flight response. Thyroid gland. So here we see the thyroid gland just below the thyroid cartilage, anterior neck, kind of looks like a butterfly. And it has another gland associated with it, which we can't see on the slide, that are on the posterior. There's about one here, one little dot here, one here and here. Anybody remember what else? What other gland is contained within the thyroid gland? It's called the parathyroids, right? Para means on either side, right? So on either side of this thyroid gland, we have the parathyroid glands. We'll talk about that in just a little bit. So what about this thyroid gland? What stimulates the thyroid gland to grow and to secrete thyroid hormone?
Thyroid-stimulating
hormone. Where does that come from? It comes from the anterior pituitary. How does the anterior pituitary know when to secrete thyroid-stimulating hormone? Yeah, when the hypothalamus releases thyroid-stimulating hormone, releasing hormone. Right. Okay. All right, so after that, the rest of this discussion is going to be nice and simple. Okay, so the thyroid gland secretes something we call T4 and T3, and it sets one of the things that it does, it sets basal metabolic rate. It's necessary for growth and development, especially nervous system. So if somebody is growing up without a thyroid gland, then their nervous system won't grow, won't develop, and it produces mental retardation as a result. So we're really interested in the thyroid gland. T3 and T4 just means that it's the amount of iodine that is incorporated into the thyroid hormone. All right, if it's T4, there are 4 molecules of iodine, or atoms of iodine. If it's T3, there are 3. So sometimes we call T4 tetraiodothreonine, and T3 is triiodothreonine. And that's exactly why we don't ever say tetraiodothreonine, right? Because just that is, yeah, you'll see it on, I think, the next slide. The amount of iodine that's added to a precursor of a thyroid hormone to make it competent, right? So in order for thyroxine to be competent, it has to have iodine. And I don't think you need iodine for any other process in your body, and you need some in order to make thyroid hormone. All right. Oh, it's not on the next slide. Okay. I'm going to skip over to the next one and just talk about that previous slide. So here is a circle of cells, right, that forms this little hollow antrum right here. This is what we call a follicle. And the fluid inside a follicle is just what we call follicular fluid. These are the cells of a follicle. So these are the follicular cells. Are these labeled? No. Okay. The follicular cells can take iodide, which is an anion, from the blood and move it up its concentration gradient and put it into this space inside of a follicle. And I forgot what I just called this thing. Okay, it's just follicular fluid. Okay. All right, so iodine gets in there, then it becomes oxidized and becomes an iodine molecule. These follicular cells also secrete something we call thyroglobulin, which is a big protein, and enzymes, so that this iodine can be incorporated into parts of thyroglobulin, which is a big, huge molecule. Right, sometimes I can see that the thyroglobulin will be conjugated with one iodine molecule. We call that tyrosine. All right, sometimes 2R, right, diiodothreonine, and then 2 diiodothreonines can join together to form that tetra, or a mono and a di can be used to make the triiodothreonine. And these still are bound to thyroglobulin, but when a signal from the anterior pituitary, like TSH, it causes the hydrolysis of T3 and T4 from thyroglobulin, and then it is secreted outside the cell. Then it becomes the hormone, active hormone. Okay, the active form inside cells is T3, but T4 is the reservoir for T3. Most in our body is T4, and T4 is really what we call thyroxine. Thyroxine is T4, which is really the thyroid hormone. Did I miss anything that I wanted to say on this slide? I don't think I did. Okay. So, we need... you don't have a picture? You don't have a picture? I thought I had a picture in there of what thyroid hormone looks like. Okay, maybe in a previous chapter I did. Okay, when we talked about, different kinds of hormones. Okay, how far back do I have to go? Let me see. Sorry about this. Types. Here we go. All right, so here is thyroxine, or T4. You see the four iodine atoms. And here is T3. And because of these rings right here, this is a hydrophobic molecule, which means where is the receptor for thyroid hormone? It's intracellular. That's right, it's intracellular. It's not on the cell surface. Okay. But that also means that T3 and T4 don't like to dissolve in blood. So how does T3 and T4 stay dissolved in blood? It has to have a carrier protein. Okay, which is another globulin. Okay. And I think we talked about that. So here's the hypothalamus. Hypothalamus releases TRH. That's another name for thyroid-stimulating hormone, releasing hormone that goes to the anterior pituitary via that portal system of the hypothalamo-hypophyseal portal system. Gets into the anterior pituitary. Anterior pituitary releases thyroid-stimulating hormone, and the target tissue... from the anterior pituitary secretion, thyroid-stimulating hormone is the thyroid gland because it has receptors that causes the thyroid gland to grow, right? But it also causes the cleavage of T3 and T4 from thyroglobulin inside those follicles and secrete it from the thyroid gland. So now you have T3 and T4 in the blood. All right, and in order for T3 and T4 to work, what do they have to have on them? The special little atom. They have to have iodine on them. Without iodine, then you can't make T3 and T4, hence the thyroid gland can't synthesize it, but it will try. But it won't be able to complete that molecule. So if you have sufficient iodine in your diet, right? Then the thyroid gland can make T3 and T4, and depending on what the concentration is, say maybe it's deviating too low, right? This concentration feeds back to the anterior pituitary. If it's too low, anterior pituitary is going to increase thyroid stimulating hormone so that the level can go back up, right? If it is too high, then the thyroid stimulating hormone from the anterior pituitary is going to decrease. And so that's just a nice negative feedback mechanism. Sometimes, here is the normal size of a thyroid gland, and compare it to this one down over here. Can you see there's a difference in size? This one down over here is large, and it can be, so I have a pretty normal thyroid gland, right? Under certain conditions, a thyroid gland can be as big as your fist, right? In which case, if I had a thyroid gland that big, would you be able to tell?
Yes.
Oh, absolutely. Even in the back row, you would be able to tell. That's what we call a goiter, right? Somebody can get goiter from a number of reasons, but mostly it's because they don't have iodine in their diet. And so what does that have to do? Well, the thyroid gland can make thyroglobulin, right? So it grows, makes a lot of thyroglobulin and follicles. Right, and if there's no T3 and T4, there is nothing to feed back to the anterior pituitary. So the anterior pituitary says, oh, I don't see any thyroid hormone. What should I do? I better tell the thyroid gland to get busy, grow, and make thyroid hormone, thyroxine. So it sends a signal out, thyroid stimulating hormone, goes to the thyroid gland. Thyroid gland has receptors for TSH, so it starts to grow and get ready to make a lot of thyroxine, but can it make thyroxine? It can't because there's no iodine, right? And so since there's no iodine, the anterior pituitary sees there's no iodine, it says, oh, thyroid gland, you better start making some, secretes TSH. And so here we have a nice positive feedback mechanism if there is no iodine present in somebody's diet. And as a result, this thyroid gland grows and grows and grows. But that's not such a terrible thing. The terrible thing is that the thyroid gland is not secreting thyroid hormone. The second gland that's inside the thyroid gland are the parathyroids, and they are stimulated directly by blood concentrations of calcium ions. Right. So here we have the parathyroids. They secrete parathyroid hormone. When blood calcium decreases, right, the parathyroids secrete parathyroid hormone, and it has two effects. It goes to the kidneys, and it can go to bone. When it goes to bone, it activates osteoclasts, or it changes the balance between osteoclasts and osteoblasts so that the clasts have more activity. And what does a clasp do, osteoclast? It breaks down bone, right? So it starts to break down bone, releases hydroxyapatite, which increases blood calcium, right? Which then feeds back to the parathyroid glands. And so here is a nice negative feedback mechanism. The second organ are the kidneys, and parathyroid hormone stimulates the kidneys to resorb calcium from filtrate. And when the kidneys resorb something, where do they put it? If they resorb something from filtrate. Filtrate is a fluid in a nephron that will eventually become urine, and you'll lose it from the body. But if you take something from filtrate, it goes back into the blood, and consider blood inside your body, right? So that's what the kidneys do. And so that results in what? Decreased urinary excretion of calcium, and that increases blood calcium, and again, that's a nice negative feedback mechanism. There is another hormone, and it's controversial in humans. I don't know for sure if it really works. It's called calcitonin, right? Calcitonin would have the opposite effect of parathyroid hormone. So calcitonin would be something that would build bones up. And maybe calcitonin can be used sometime, or something similar to calcitonin, to help with a disease process called osteoporosis, right? Okay. All right. Yeah, I think it's active very early on, then becomes inactive, but it stays active in some animals their entire life. Okay. islets of Langerhans. So we're leaving the thyroid and parathyroid, going into the islets of Langerhans. And this is just a blast from the past because you know where these are? Yeah, these are in the pancreas. All right, so the pancreas, here's the pancreas, has a couple functions. Part is exocrine. What does exocrine mean? It's a gland that secretes a product into a exocrine, into a duct, and then the duct carries that product to wherever it's supposed to act. Right, so the pancreas produces digestive enzymes that end up in the small intestine. Those digestive enzymes shouldn't be running around inside the pancreas because what would happen to the pancreas then? Well, it'd digest itself, right? And that's one of the problems with pancreatitis, pancreatic cancer, right? You can imagine when the body starts to digest itself from the inside out. All right, but the second function is endocrine. The follicular cells produce enzymes. The cells between follicles produce hormones. And there are two kinds of cells, alpha and beta cells. Right? And so that's why they're called little islets, because they look like little islands between the follicles that produce the exocrine digestive enzymes. Right? And the alpha secrete the hormone called glucagon in response to low blood glucose. All right? So what would the effect of glucagon be? If it's secreted by the pancreas when blood glucose is low, it will have a tendency to increase blood glucose. How does it do that? It stimulates glycogenolysis and lipolysis, and we've seen that before. Okay, so glucagon does what? Increases blood glucose. So we've seen a whole bunch of things that increase blood glucose, not many things that decrease blood glucose so far. As a matter of fact, only one thing. Okay. All right, so, and then the beta cells secrete insulin. And what does insulin do? Decreases blood glucose because it's the passport that allows glucose to enter cells, and it basically prevents them from starving to death. Okay, so here are two antagonistic hormones. And let's look at this flow diagram. If blood glucose concentration increases, and you should tell me when that happens, when does blood glucose concentration increase? Yeah, when you're in a fed state, like eat a candy bar or something. Okay, so blood glucose increases, and that will stimulate the beta cells, right? Beta cells will secrete insulin, right? And that's going to increase cellular uptake of blood glucose. What's the transporter? What's the name of the transporter that allows cells to take up glucose? The GLUT4 transporter. GLUT4 transporter. All right, so that's inserted in the membrane. That's a facilitated diffusion transporter. So glucose enters cells. It can be put into glycogen and liver and muscle, and it can also be used as a precursor to make fat, triglycerides. So adipose tissue can use glucose. All right, and as blood glucose decreases, right, blood glucose decreases, what happens to the pancreas? Right, it feeds back and it stops the secretion or tones down the secretion of insulin so that it keeps blood glucose within a normal range. Okay. I want to go back to this slide way back over here. So how does insulin work? It inserts GLUT4 transporters from endosomes into the cell membrane. Right, and so these are GLUT4 transporters in an endosome that are inactive, but they're in the reserve. Right, they can be inserted into the membrane rapidly when there is an insulin signal. Okay, there is something else that can insert GLUT4 transporters into the cell membrane besides insulin. Besides insulin, anybody have a guess what that could be? What happens when somebody's diagnosed early with diabetes? What are the things that they're told to do?
Exercise.
I know. Don't throw anything at me. Okay. Exercise. When you contract muscle, that also causes these endosomes to insert into the cell membrane. So exercise is like what? Is like an insulin signal, right? So that's why exercise is always recommended. Or prescribed, actually it's prescribed, all right, for a diabetic condition, because it inserts these GLUT4 transporters. So I don't know if anybody in here has been told to exercise because of blood glucose levels, and you can't imagine why. exercise is not a lot of fun for some people. All right, and I hope if anybody's in here, okay, that you will see that it really should be something fun for you to do, or maybe a family member, right? So really support them if they're a diabetic, that they get some exercise, they use some of their muscles, because what does that do? It decreases blood glucose for them, even though they have many, many other mechanisms that increase blood glucose, right? And we saw some of those things already. Okay. So that's the endocrine chapter. Is that everything in the endocrine chapter? Yeah, so we saw two hormones that work, actually four hormones, they're two pairs of hormones that work antagonistically to each other. Can anybody mention two hormones that are antagonistic to each other? Insulin and glucagon over here, extra credit point. What's another one? Parathyroid hormone and calcitonin. All right, so you should really know a lot about antagonism in musculoskeletal system, in the nervous system, endocrine system, all these systems to maintain precise control and balance over what they're controlling, like blood glucose, for instance. Okay, gee whiz, what's next? No, we're done with that. Should be muscle, right? Okay. Oh, well, I'm glad we're getting started on this because a lot of this stuff right here is really from anatomy. We'll get this taken care of today. All right, skeletal muscle structure. As a matter of fact, before we get to skeletal muscle, you should tell me how many different kinds of, or how, what are the muscle types? How many muscle types are there? Okay. The major ones, I say three. Okay, and they are? Smooth. I heard smooth. I heard skeletal. I heard cardiac. Yeah, so it's those three. It doesn't matter what order they're in. And the first one we are going to talk about, so the order sort of does matter, is skeletal muscle. All right, so here is a skeletal muscle. This could be like the coracobrachialis or biceps brachii, triceps brachii. And I'm not going to name all the connective tissue sheaths around this because you know that already. All right, but so here's the muscle and the building block of a muscle. If you were to cut a muscle open, you would see some compartments. What are those compartments called? See these compartments? Yeah, fascicles, right? And there's connective tissue around that. And then what's the building block of a fascicle? It is a muscle cell or muscle fiber. And a skeletal muscle cell is called a fiber. As a matter of fact, I should just call it a fiber from now on because it's a very long linear cell and it looks like a thread. Right? It looks like a fiber, so muscle fiber. So when I say muscle fiber, should you think of smooth muscle, cardiac muscle, or skeletal muscle? Skeletal. Only skeletal muscle. Okay, and so here is a fascicle, and the building block of a fascicle is a muscle fiber. And if we look at a muscle fiber, here's a muscle fiber. All right, do you see other structures inside the fiber?
Yes.
Indeed. Okay, there are organelles for contraction. All right, so how do you make them, what do you have to add together, put together to make a muscle fiber? What's a building block? Yeah, the building block of a muscle fiber, you guys are great. Okay, I'm spending way too much time on this. Is a, myofibril. Myofibril is the organelle of contraction. All right, and then if we look at a myofibril that we have right here, do you see structures inside the myofibril?
Yes.
Yes, and those are the proteins that make it up. Name the two that you're familiar with, most important, actin and myosin. And they have different thicknesses. One is thin, one is thick. Go ahead, tell me the thick one is called myosin and the thin one is called actin. There's some other proteins. There's one more that we're going to look at in a little bit. All right, so, yeah, I lost the mic, but that's okay. So make sure you can go up and down that level of organization. Like what do you have to, what's the building block of a muscle? Fascicle. What's the building block of a fascicle? A muscle fiber. What's the building block of a muscle fiber? Myofibril. What's the building block of a myofibril? Yeah, myofilaments. Myofilaments, and the examples would be actin and myosin. Okay. Okay. Here you see a skeletal muscle, linear cell, has many nuclei because at one time during development it was many cells that joined together just in a row. Right, and it is striated. It's striated because of the machinery inside the cell that causes it to contract within the myofibrils, and those are what we call sarcomeres. Right, sarcomeres produce these striations, and they're really evident underneath the microscope. We're going to get to that sarcomere in just a little bit, but the sarcomere is the structural and functional unit of contraction. So if you know how one sarcomere shortens, you know how they all shorten, right? And a myofibril is just made up of sarcomeres. A muscle fiber is just made up of myofibril, so you learn a lot about contraction. Okay. Well, here is a muscle cell, right? Because I can see myofibrils. I can even see some myofilaments inside of the cell. Skeletal muscle is controlled by your somatic motor neurons. So here is a motor neuron, and here's the axon terminus. I don't see any terminal buttons. I don't see any little swellings, right? Because I see this highly branched pattern, right? And this branch pattern right here, all along these processes can release the neurotransmitter. And you should all know what the neurotransmitter 100% cases for this junction between a motor neuron and a muscle cell. It's always acetylcholine. That's right. And acetylcholine is a neurotransmitter. It's got to bind to a receptor, okay? And that receptor is excitatory 100% of the time. What kind of cholinergic receptor you know is excitatory? Yeah, it's the nicotinic kind. It's not a muscarinic, right? So there are ligand-gated channels and of the nicotinic type. And so this is very similar to a regular synapse between two neurons, but there are some differences, right? When the postsynaptic cell is excited, it doesn't move, right? It doesn't try to pull away from the synapse. But what can you tell me about a muscle when it's excited? It's gonna contract. It's gonna wanna pull away from this somatic motor neuron. So there's some specializations of this junction. This is called the neuromuscular junction, right? So there are folds in the sarcolemma. Right, there's these deep rifts so that this thing doesn't have a name. I don't know what this thing is called. Part of the axon terminus actually inserts itself right into these folds of the muscle cell membrane so that they can't pull apart. So that's one interesting difference. Right, so there are some physical constraints that glue the motor neuron to the muscle cell. There are some other things. All right, so we said it's a nicotinic type synapse, so it has to have nicotinic receptors, right, on this postsynaptic membrane, the muscle cell membrane. And what kind of, it's a channel. What kind of channel is that? A nicotinic receptor. What kind of channel? Ligand-gated channel. Perfect, 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 perfect. Where do you have ligand-gated channels on a neuron? Let's talk about a neuron first. Where do you have ligand-gated channels? Dendrites and cell bodies, right? Can a dendrite and cell body produce an action potential or carry an action potential? No. What do you need for that? Okay. Yeah, the structure is an axon. What does an axon have that allows it to produce an action potential and actually transmit it? Voltage-gated channels. Okay. Now, where do you have voltage-gated channels in a neuron? Okay. Along that axon, nodes of Ranvier are there. They start at the axon hillock, right? So cell body dendrites do not have voltage-gated channels, so dendrites, cell bodies, can't produce action potentials. Now, here is some, and that's where you have synapses, right? Dendrites and cell bodies. Here's something interesting about the neuromuscular junction. Not only does it have ligand-gated channels, it also has voltage-gated channels, right? So as soon as acetylcholine is released into the neuromuscular junction or from within the neuromuscular junction, right, the nicotinic channels open up, right, and that causes, what does that cause when those nicotinic, depolarization, which is a big change in membrane potential, and then right next door there are voltage-gated channels, so then what happens? Action potential, right. So within the neuromuscular junction, action potentials take place. So graded potentials really don't have to travel anywhere, right? So as soon as acetylcholine is released, what is the only response that a skeletal muscle can do? Yeah, it can only contract, right? And it can't make up its mind if the stimulus was threshold or not. It is always threshold. When you send action potential down a somatic motor neuron, it always reaches threshold because you have ligand-gated channels and voltage-gated channels in the same location, right? Which then causes muscle contraction. All right. So sometimes we call this the motor end plate. It's nicotinic channels. And maybe just one more thing I can talk about. Motor unit. So here is a muscle. Maybe that's biceps, brachii. And here are a bunch of muscle fibers, all right, in this particular muscle. And a muscle fiber either contracts to 100% of its ability or not at all. It's an all or none response. And unless it's damaged, then maybe something else can happen. But a normal fiber contracts 100% of the time or not. So how is it that I can pick up this very light bottle that is only has a quarter of Coca-Cola in it? Okay, how is it that I can pick up something very light and not smash it into my head because every single muscle cell has to contract at its maximum, no matter what? Yes, and that's because when I pick up something light, I don't use all of the muscle fibers within a muscle, only certain ones. And if the object is heavier, then, yeah, you would add muscle fibers to contract. And so there's something called a motor unit. Motor unit is the somatic motor neuron going to the muscle and how many muscle fibers that one neuron, right, is associated with. And in this particular case, I see three. So this motor, this neuron would produce a very weak contraction as opposed to one up over here would produce a much stronger contraction because you see it going to many more nerve fibers. We call that recruitment. Okay. The innervation ratio is just the number of muscle fibers that are connected to one motor neuron. Right? It can vary from 1 to 100, 1 to 2,000. So what would give you more fine control, more discrete control, 1 to 100 or 1 to 2,000? 1 to 100, right? So for instance, in your face, in your hands, and so 1 to 2,000, that would be more for like postural muscles, right, in your back. Okay, this is a little strange. It says, what does it say? Fine control occurs when motor units are small. Fine control when motor units are small. Well, what that means is few muscle fibers, right? If you take 1 and divide it by 100, that is a lot larger than if you take 1 divided by 2,000, right? So just kind of be aware that this statement and these numbers right here just kind of don't match up exactly, right? So, small number of muscle fibers, right, gives you more and fine control. And we talked about recruitment. So next time, we're going to start with structure of a muscle fiber, but I probably won't spend a whole lot of time because this is just anatomy. I'd rather talk about physiology in this chapter. It's got some physio.
Yeah, I noticed that when I was reading the chapter.
Troponin, tropomyosin. I didn't get into an anatomy very much.
Yeah.
Okay.
Because even when I was reading through the slides and stuff earlier and through the chapter, it's all pretty much recap.
Different kinds of receptors.
Yeah. So not too much on that chapter. It's probably going to be one of the easier ones.
Maybe.
Yeah, hopefully that will iron itself out this semester.
Yeah.